Well, forgive me for restating the bleeding obvious, dear listener, but since 9/11, or September 11, as we more correctly call it in our neck of the Antipodes, we've been obsessed with terrorism and the so-called masterminds of terror, Al-Qaeda. The media is chocker with stories about terrorists, terrorist plots. Every week a new book appears, and we interview the authors, as they claim to give us the inside story on Osama bin Laden. And the pollies from across the globe and the political perspective make speeches about how terrorism is threatening our way of life and the very foundation of civilization as we know it. And as our own PM keeps reminding us, the world post-September 11 is a different and more dangerous place. Now, the fear of terrorism is something that touches almost all our lives, whether it's the fridge magnet sent to us by our government, increased security at airports, or constant alerts about where we should and shouldn't travel in the world. The situation in the US, of course, is even more extreme. The American Red Cross has developed a school curriculum called Masters of Disaster, designed to teach kids what to do during a terrorist attack. Does that remind you of those ducking commercials that you saw during the Cold War, where kids used to jump underneath their desks, thus warding off nuclear catastrophe? But has our reaction to the recent attacks in Madrid, Bali and the US been wholly rational? Were these attacks fundamentally or profoundly different from terrorist attacks of the past? Have the attacks been masterminded by a super terrorist organisation with tentacles across the globe and headed by bin Laden? And were they, as Bush, Blair and Howard would have us believe, a serious threat to the Western world? Now, joining me to try and unpack some of the mythology surrounding terrorism and our responses to it, Thomas Naylor, an economist, criminologist and historian at McGill University in Montreal. His major area of research is the study of black markets, the financial affairs of terrorist and criminal organisations, and the effects of economic warfare on underworld economies. His most recent book is Wages of Crime, Black Markets, Illegal Finance and Underworld Economy. And he's on the blower from his home in Canada. Joining us from the ABC studio in London, Brendan O'Neill. Brendan is a London-based journalist and assistant editor of the online magazine Spiked. And on the line from his home in Singapore, Adam Dolnick. Adam is currently a PhD scholar and a research associate at the International Centre for Political Violence and Terrorism Research at the Institute of Defence and Strategic Studies in, yes, Singapore. Previously, Adam worked as a researcher at the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Project at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in California and at the United Nations Terrorism Prevention Branch in Vienna. So his areas of expertise include tactical, technological innovation in terrorist campaigns, motivations and strategies, crisis negotiations, etc. Now, Adam, you argue that our notion of one super terrorist organisation run by bin Laden is wrong. Why is that?
Well, I think the main reason why is that this is not the reality. Al-Qaeda, as an original group around bin Laden, consisted of a maximum of 4,000 people. Now, most of the people immediately in bin Laden's surroundings have been captured or killed or are on the run. So many of the attacks that we're seeing after 9/11 have been attacks perpetrated by Al-Qaeda associate groups. What I mean by Al-Qaeda associate groups is that there have been meetings between Al-Qaeda representatives and representatives from regional organizations that have been responsible for those attacks. Those are not actually Al-Qaeda attacks per se.
But what you're implying is that during the years when bin Laden was, you know, was gung-ho in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda bases were training recruits from around the globe, there was a coherent network.
No, I wouldn't say it's a coherent network. I would give you an example from our field, from terrorism studies. We meet each other at conferences, all the people in terrorism studies. We talk to each other, have dinners together. When we need information, we can contact each other through email or give each other a phone call and we can help each other out. Does that make us a single entity, a single think tank?
I think it does, Adam, and I think you're running it. It's very sinister.
Okay, point taken.
So how should we be thinking about these groups, if not as one coherent group? How would you more usefully define the phenomenon?
I would define it as Al-Qaeda as we saw it, a group that is on the run and no longer capable of international attacks in the way it was prior to 9/11. The organizations that perpetrate large-scale attacks are not Al-Qaeda, and they are organizations that have their own regional interests. Now, if you look at the Jemaah Islamiyah network in Southeast Asia...
We look at it very frequently because it's in the neighborhood.
Yes, of course. This organization has very different strategic thinking than Al-Qaeda. It has its regional goals. It has, however, had contact through Hanbali with bin Laden, and through some of the funding coming from Al-Qaeda, it was able to adopt some of Al-Qaeda methods and tactics. Now, whether these were in accordance with actual JI strategies is another question.
Now, Thomas, you compare the idea of Al-Qaeda with the Mafia as a sort of a convenient bogeyman for the purposes of manipulation.
Well, they're both myths largely created by the police force's imaginations. They're, as Adam described, in fact, I would take it one step further. I wouldn't even describe the original group of 4,000 as Al-Qaeda, because effectively you had, let's call it an inner core of people who were around bin Laden. There weren't very many of them. They often had completely different agendas. They didn't necessarily agree on everything. Then there were the people who came to Afghanistan and were trained with them there. Then they scattered. I don't think you could even say there were 4,000 to begin with that were members of anything. In fact, I don't think there's any organization to be a member of here. And by the way, I would interject here, even and possibly disagree with something Adam said, I'm still waiting for some proof that bin Laden had a direct, not necessarily, I'm not saying he didn't have a moral and exhortatory role, but a direct conspiratorial role in 9/11. To me, when I look at the evidence, I see a plot that was hatched in Hamburg and to some degree in Spain by a group of people, some of whom went to Afghanistan. But as far as I can tell, they're like so many others. They went there occasionally. He gave them a pat on the head. Sometimes he gave them some pocket change and sent them off to do whatever wacky scheme they had already dreamed up all by themselves.
So you're being pretty naughty here, Thomas. You're implying that it doesn't exist except in the fevered imaginations of neocons and Likudniks.
Well, look, it actually, there's a fair amount of truth to these creations, because remember, the police and intelligence services have a problem. They try to prosecute these things under conspiracy laws. And to have a conspiracy, you got to concoct organizational structures. That's how they go after the mafia. When any decent scholar of the mafia will tell you, mafia is a mode of behavior. It's not an organization. Yet, nonetheless, we end up prosecuting them as criminal conspiracies. Much the same is happening here. You have arms-length associations of people who sometimes know each other. Sometimes they actually don't. Sometimes they're simply inspired. So you have, as Adam described, a whole plethora of groups spread all over the world with their own regional agendas, sometimes interacting. But if they do interact, and this is the critical thing, it's not on a vertical basis with a mastermind of terror sitting somewhere in Tora Bora, but rather it's a set of horizontal, arm's-length, autonomous interrelations among members of peer groups.
Now, Thomas, why has the U.S. and other Western governments been so willing to emphasize this brand name concept, the idea of a super terrorist organization? What's in it for those governments?
There's several things. One is that legally, if you're going to prosecute, you want to conjure up the notion of a coherent organization, which is what they've done with the so-called concept of organized crime, which is another largely mythical construct, incidentally. Secondly, let's face it, if you're fighting an idea, it's pretty hard to drop bombs on an idea. You've got to have something more concrete. And if you say, look, we're dropping bombs all over Afghanistan, we're using cluster bombs, we're spreading depleted uranium for what, to fight an idea, that doesn't go down so well. And thirdly, I think a lot of these people naively actually believe it. They actually believe there's some sort of coherent structure. Let's not overestimate the intelligence and wisdom of people who make important decisions.
Oh, let's never do that, Thomas. Let's never do that. No. Brendan, how many people are actually killed annually by terrorists, you know, on an actuarial basis?
Well, it depends what kind of terrorism you're talking about, but if we're talking about international terrorism, then according to the US State Department itself, the numbers remained fairly static throughout the 1990s at about 300 or 350 a year. And I should say that international terrorism is defined by the State Department as terrorism that involves people or territory from two or more states. So that covers acts like, for example, Bali or 9-1-1 or Madrid and so on. So in terms of how many people terrorism actually kills, it's actually not a great number, and it's in many ways much smaller than it, political violence in the past used to kill. So I think there is something else going on here. Terrorism is not necessarily the great threat to humanity that people make out. It's quite a small, generally localized, and not particularly threatening phenomenon. So I
think Brendan, is it therefore a politically advantageous concept for governments who want to stay in office?
To a certain extent. However, I must take issue a little bit with what Thomas was saying. I completely agree that it's mythical. It's a myth that bin Laden is sitting in a cave somewhere concocting all these attacks around the world. But I equally think it's a myth that Bush and Blair have their meetings in Texas or London or Washington and concoct myths about Al-Qaeda and dream up a kind of conspiracy to justify their own role in the world. I think that's equally wrong. I think really what's going on is that there's a sense of fear in the West, a sense of isolation, fear, uncertainty, and that leads people to kind of try and create outside forces, you know, the notion that we are constantly under threat. So I think it's not a conspiracy that has created this idea of Al-Qaeda as this kind of all-powerful, all-conquering, super-terrorist organization. It's not a conspiracy because Bush and Blair want to go to Iraq and Bush and Blair want to go to Afghanistan. Rather, I think it's a much more organic, subtle relationship between the West and terrorism, where fear over here in the West can actually lead us to see terrorism everywhere as this all-powerful threat, when in fact it's not really like that.
Now, Adam, you won't quite agree with that, because you wrote just after the Madrid bombings that terrorism is essentially a psychological mind game, the objective of which is to create the universal perception of vulnerability.
Absolutely, and actually I think that goes in accordance with what Brandon was saying. I would like to react first to your question about how many people die in international terrorist incidents annually. Let me give you a comparison. If you're an American citizen, you are statistically the most likely nationality to be targeted by international terrorism. Yet, an American has the same chance, statistically, to die in a terrorist attack as to be killed by lightning. And yet we invest $20 billion annually, or the Americans do it. And at the same time, the average American is not worried about walking outside when it's raining. So I think this clearly shows us that is there something like a rational response to terrorism? I think we can't really live with the threat, the universality of it. We feel that it can come at any time. Any one of us can be a victim. This is precisely what indiscriminate attacks try to do, to create that perception. Now, in terrorism, perception is everything. It is more important than reality. And in this sense, this is why I think it's very useful to have the debate about what Al-Qaeda is and what it is not.
Thomas, one of the US's key responses to terrorism has been to try and cut off the flow of money to the so-called terrorist groups. It's a tactic they've also used in relation to the mafia, of course, and so-called organized crime groups. This has its problems, doesn't it?
Well,
I mean, moral and ethical problems as well as tactical.
Well, let's focus on the actual tactical and strategic problems here. It's ultimately premised on the same myth that you have one super rich mastermind of terrorism, which again harkens back to the mafia godfather myth. And in fact, look, I mean, everybody who's traced this down coherently has come to the pretty much the same answer. Bin Laden had some money. It wasn't a hell of a lot. Most of it was frozen or stolen from him when he was in the Sudan. Most of these operations, I mean, sure, some he gives some change to this person or to the other, but A, these terrorist acts can be quite horrendous without costing very much money. After all, it costs about $2,000 for Timothy McVeigh to blow up the Oklahoma Federal Building.
And it doesn't actually cost a lot of money to hijack a couple of Boeings, does it?
Money is not the issue. And even if a fair amount of money is necessary, the key thing here is motivation. If you have people who are motivated, they will find the money. And there's all kinds of ways you can do it. So the notion that there's sort of a money lifeline that's keeping terrorism alive is nonsense. And all of this, the effort put into cutting the lifeline, frankly, to me, is a wasted effort.
I mentioned the ethical dimension because, of course, for Muslims, giving to charity is more than an individual moral choice. It's one of the five pillars of Islam, isn't it?
Well, yes, and it's more important than that because of creditor country pressures, the governments cut back on social spending and so on in a lot of Islamic countries. They're dependent increasingly on the lifeline that's thrown to them by the charities raising money abroad. And these are being cut off. I mean, for example, the disaster in Somalia that resulted from closing down Al Barakat, which turned out to be a total fraud. 2 years later, the Bush administration finally quietly told the UN to remove this remittance company from its list of terrorist organizations. By that point, nearly half the families in a benighted place like Somalia had had their outside funding cut off, and the place, of course, regressed even further into anarchy and misery.
Thomas, it's also true that the targeting of fundamentalist charities has been rather narrowly focused on the Muslims.
Exactly, whereas nobody is in the United States targeting the Jewish terrorist groups that are active in the West Bank, and they're raising money quite openly across the United States. The Hindu terrorist groups that were responsible for the Gujarat massacre and other things have raised money. The Tamil Tigers, and let's remember the IRA, which for 20 or 30 years raised money without any problem in the United States.
Let me remind you, dear listener, that this is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, and the WWW, and my guests are Thomas Naylor, historian at McGill, Brendan O'Neill, assistant editor of the London online magazine Spiked, and Adam Dolnick, research associate at the International Centre for Political Violence, Deep Breath and Terrorism Research at the Institute of Defence and Strategic Studies in Singapore. Adam, many Western leaders would argue that the attacks in Madrid, Bali and the US are fundamentally different from those seen in the past. That's not entirely accurate, is it?
Meaning entirely different in the modus operandi that was used?
In modus operandi, in inspiration, even in strategy.
Well, I would say that the attacks, all three actually that you mentioned, confirm a tendency of international terrorism of, say, the past 15 years. There's a great tendency of terrorist organizations when perpetrating attacks to use a synchronization several attacks at once, to be as impressive as possible, but also to be as lethal as possible. Also, the use of suicide bombings is in particular striking because since 1981, when there was the first suicide attack of modern history in Lebanon, there have been over 500 suicide attacks since that date, carried out in 26 different countries by 24 different organizations. So clearly, I would say these attacks, whether it's Bali, Madrid, or 9/11, are definitely moving along the trend of international terrorism. I don't think they come up with anything new.
Brendan, over the past 150 years, terrorism has taken many different forms. You've written on this.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think there is something very different about the kind of violence that we see today. I agree with Adam that it's something that's been developing over the past 15 to 20 years. It hasn't just happened. But if you compare it to the political violence of the past, off groups like the IRA, who Thomas mentioned, and the PLO and other such groups, those groups had political goals. They were politically motivated, and their attacks, their use of violence reflected that. Generally speaking, their attacks were targeted against police or military figures or economic targets, or occasionally they would do a spectacular kind of international attack, such as a hijacking, in order to bring attention to their political demands. However, what we have today, it seems to me, is violence for its own sake. You know, I really disagree with people who argue that Al-Qaeda has a broader political, religious, social goal. There's no evidence of that, and instead we have these kind of sporadic, occasional, disparate, nihilistic attacks where the aim seems to be only one thing, to cause massive disruption and to kill as many civilians as possible. People who used political violence in the past, generally speaking, did not target civilians, or not purposefully, and what we have today are terrorists whose aim is to kill as many civilians as they possibly can. The aim is to shock us, to disturb us, to make us feel awful and vulnerable and isolated, and I think in that terrorism sometimes succeeds. But I just want to quickly come back to something Adam said earlier about terrorism seeks to have a psychological impact, because I think that's the key to it, and I think that's really true. Terrorists are generally small, isolated groups of people who cannot change societies fundamentally. I mean, Al-Qaeda or whoever it is not going to storm London or Washington or Sydney and take over political power. They are small groups who launch attacks in order to make us feel vulnerable and to have a psychological impact. And therefore, the impact of their attacks is determined to a large extent by the psychology of the target societies. In other words, by how target societies feel about themselves and their way of lives, how confident they are, how sure of themselves they are, and so on. So I think the key to this is that in many ways the impact that terrorism has today across the globe is not determined by the terrorists themselves, even though they are doing new and disturbing things, but rather by a sense of vulnerability and fear and uncertainty in the target societies. I think it's that which allows terrorist attacks to have such a massive, disproportionate impact.
Brendan, earlier this week I was chairing a session at a very large conference, 3,000 people attending, on public health issues, and we did a session on bioterrorism and public health, and talked to a couple of George Bush's warriors in that particular cause, and it became quite obvious that down the track the discussion we're having may become absolutely irrelevant if and when terrorist groups do get WMDs of one sort or another.
Yes, that may be so, but I think that shows up another aspect of the discussion about terrorism today, which is it's very speculative. What if is the scenario that's always raised? What if bin Laden did get WMDs? What if terrorists did get their hands on smallpox and so on? None of which seem to be particularly likely scenarios, and certainly there's no strong evidence to indicate that terrorists have got access to these kind of things. Most of the terrorist attacks over the past, since 9/11, have been, not very well constructed bombs made from fertilizer and so on, which are exploded in places where.
So, Brendan, you're not particularly worried about the stories coming out of Pakistan trading, illicitly in nuclear technologies, or the thought that the ruins of the Soviet Union are also providing access to terrorist groups of nuclear materials?
Not particularly, no. I think there are more pressing things to worry about. I mean, certainly on the nuclear front, there are other things for us to worry about than what Pakistan is doing. I think it really does come back to this psychology thing. I really think that's the key thing here, where the more we fret about these things, the more we speculate, the more we reorganise our societies at home around protecting ourselves against terrorism, constantly thinking about terrorism, constantly worrying about terrorism, the danger of that, this is not just an academic point, I'm not just saying that will make us more depressed and that will make us all a bit sad. There's a more profound danger, which is that we will inflame terrorism.
The only time I've ever agreed with Margaret Thatcher about anything was when she said we should deny terrorists the oxygen of publicity, but it's very hard to deny them that oxygen, isn't it, in a world dominated by communications technology.
Yeah, that's also the only time I've ever agreed with Thatcher as well, but I think it's important that we get this into proportion and that we look at things rationally, because the danger is otherwise that the terrorists will come, it will be a self-fulfilling prophecy to a certain extent. We will talk them up into a position where they are actually posing as this kind of terrible threat to humanity, and they're not at all.
Brendan, I totally agree with you. Do you agree with Brendan Thomas?
Yes, in fact, I'd take it one step further and say that what we ought to be doing is treating these people as criminals, and going after them with the criminal justice system. But when you actually treat them as a military threat, then you give them precisely the publicity that they seek, and therefore, of course, inevitably inflame it. And that, of course, has its own sick logic, because it feeds back to the countries who are responding, and they in turn further militarize their responses to these things. And we get into an almost impossible loop that's hard to break out of.
Adam Dolnick, it intrigues me that I grew up in a world where there was the genuine threat of mutual assured destruction, where you had a Cold War with the nuclear clock ticking towards midnight. That goes away, and now all human attention has gone to this other issue, which I think, as Brendan and Thomas says, is essentially a gross exaggeration. It would seem in some way that we need to be afraid, Adam.
Actually, no, I don't think so. I think if you look at the age of MAD, the mutually assured destruction, I think people were also disproportionately afraid. And if you look back at events like the Cuban Missile Crisis, historically, now that it's over, we realize that there was never really a close threat of a nuclear exchange. And I think it's similar with the threat of terrorism. I think we fear it so much because we feel that it is so imminent and it happens in our time. I think that this is maybe why we're sort of struggling with what Al-Qaeda is or is not. I think we can't really live with the idea of an ambiguous enemy of several individuals. I think that's how the construct of a super powerful organization comes along, because we sort of try to substitute the Eastern Bloc with some kind of an enemy. And we're not really experienced in handling that perception.
And yet it would be very difficult for even a visionary politician to run this moderating line. He or she would simply be dismissed as a danger to their society and to themselves. They would be seen as woozers.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right, and that's the difficulty. And I think actually, I also wanted to say that when we look at the trends in terrorism and how it historically has developed, I think we're only looking at trends in post World War II, and I don't think we have a large enough sample historically to look and really say how world has changed. I think we will learn a lot more about this new breed of terrorism in the next 20 years, and hopefully we'll learn to live with it or learn to counter it.
Thomas, what about the impact of the war on terror as it is, well, let's take a region, in the Middle East. What impact is it going to have on the dynamics of the regional politics?
Well, look, I'm going to say things that will probably surprise a lot of people. I don't think it has nearly as big an impact as people suggest. I mean, when I travel to the Middle East, I see millions of people who are getting on with their lives, who are economically in very bad situation, and their main concern is survival. And they're, you know, these things happen, but they don't really feel that much like it's part of them. Nobody there that I've met, I mean, I talked to millions of people, well, millions, obvious exaggeration, but I talked to as many people from as many walks of life as I can, and I never got the impression there was a groundswell of support for bin Laden and so on. Many of the tales that you hear in the media here about the groundswell of support for Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, to me, are unmitigated nonsense. Certainly people are becoming more religious in many countries, but that can be a profoundly conservative thing. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to grab control of a plane and crash it into the nearest big building. I don't see that that's their main concern right now. It's economic survival. And to the extent that there's political agitation, it's agitation against corrupt regimes, which, again, are largely the local regime that people are focusing on. There's no sense of this grand Islamic jihad that the neocons in and around Washington are trying to claim exists. It just is not there.
Brendan, you get a phone call from the palace and you're asked to go there by Her Majesty, who says, Brendan O'Neill, former government. What would you do on this issue? What would you want to say to the British people?
What would I do? My God, I don't think Her Majesty would agree with me, but I would instantly call a halt to the war on terror, which I think is a disaster. A complete disaster. It's been a disaster for Afghanistan, and it's been profoundly destabilizing in many parts of the world. But more importantly, the reason I would call a halt to the war on terror is because I think it's misplaced. I think we're looking in the wrong place for these terrorists, if that's what the war on terror is supposed to be doing. If, for example, you look at 9/11, the people who executed that attack, largely speaking, were not poverty-stricken Palestinians or the kind of people that we are told really hate the West and really want to
destroy
the West.
They were imbued in Western culture, weren't they?
They were imbued in Western culture. That, you know, they'd spent a lot of time in Hamburg, some of them, or in parts of Spain. They were, most of them were, fairly middle class, fairly well-to-do. I think we're looking in the wrong place. I think we need to look at our own societies to see why it is we are so scared of terrorism when terrorism is not a big threat. Why is it that terrorism can have such a disproportionate impact that America is ploughing billions of dollars into a Department of Homeland Security?
And human rights issues are being sacrificed to that,
exactly,
on that altar, aren't they?
Yet justice and democracy are being sacrificed, and we are giving up so much and we are becoming so fearful in response to a handful of cranky lunatics who want to throw bombs at us. It's a completely and utterly disproportionate response. So if I was to form a government, I would do two things. Firstly, I would target the terrorists specifically, go after them, as Thomas was saying, treating them as criminals rather than as a kind of military phenomenon. And secondly, I would do my utmost to make society more robust. I would probably the best thing to do would be a policy of ignoring the terrorists. Just ignoring them, not reading every statement that Bin Laden puts out, not listening to every word he says as if it's the gospel truth, not treating them as some kind of threat to humanity, but doing our best to ignore them and to block them out of our minds and forget about them.
Adam Dolnick, you can't have the Prime Ministership of Great Britain. That's gone to Brendan. So you are called to the East River and you take over as Secretary General of the United Nations. What advice would you be giving UN members and the world?
Oh, I think the first thing I would do in that position is resign as quickly as possible. seriously, I think it's a very difficult position to be in, especially if you're heading a large body that the big players don't seem to be listening to when it comes to crunch time. But what I would try to encourage is a change of rhetoric in terms of what the threat is and how big this threat is. And what I would in particular try to do is engage states that we formerly used to call rogue nations, because those states like Iran or Libya have their own trouble with terrorism. And I think promoting the idea of fighting terrorism, regardless of who the victim of that terrorism is, would be a good place to start in terms of building a truly global coalition to deal with this phenomenon.
Thomas, last night on this program, I was talking to Bob Woodward about his book on the war in Iraq, and he's describing his ongoing encounters with Bush one-on-one down at the ranch in Texas. And it becomes quite clear that we're not dealing with a conspiracy theory, and that what Brendan says is right. This character actually believes it. He actually, in his heart of hearts, thinks it's true. I mean, don't you find that astonishing, given the immense power of the American, well, the so-called intelligence network, that he can come to these sort of conclusions?
George Bush is a product of a unique confluence of political circumstances. A confluence of circumstances in which the religious right, the military-industrial complex, and the oil industry have basically coalesced to form a new bloc in American power that was going to dominate American politics for a long time, I fear. And what Bush is talking about is he's simply articulating the joint interests of that group. And
well,
I think if you
that's
interpret
certainly,
it that
that's
way,
certainly not the line that Woodward runs. And okay, he's not the world's greatest journalist, but he shows you, he and Cheney as well, deeply, deeply fearful that the government is going to be decapitated by terror, that it's really on for young and old.
These things are not inconsistent, but nonetheless, the entire Bush-Cheney agenda is advancing collectively the interests of those three major coalitions. They may have their own beliefs, and don't forget, those beliefs in turn reflect in some way the material and ideological interests of those particular groups. They advance them. It doesn't mean that the man's insincere. He's just bonkers.
Brendan, what's your view of Blair in this area? Is Blair a true believer or some sort of political opportunist?
I think he's probably a bit of both, actually. I think he like as you were saying about Bush, I think he, to a certain extent, he does believe that this is a grand battle between good and evil. I mean, that's what he always says. He thinks on the good side you have Bush and Blair, and on the evil side you have just about everybody else, but in particularly the terrorists. So he does define it very much as this new war between good in the West and evil over there in the East. And I think that does tell us something about the obsession with terrorism, that there is this attempt to make it a defining issue of our age, to give ourselves a sense of purpose, you know, political leaders in particular grasping for a sense of purpose at a time when they don't seem to have any at home, so they look everywhere else and they try and make out that they're taking part.
You're talking to me from a city which has been bombed incessantly by the Germans in the Second World War, bombed more recently by the IRA. The Brits seem to have been more pragmatic, less panic-stricken. And yet you've got a Prime Minister who was so willing to be in the coalition of the willing. I find this a paradox.
It is, there is a certain paradox there. I think, just briefly, there is an interesting contrast between how Britain responded to the IRA and how Britain responds to terrorism today. I mean, during the IRA's campaign, which lasted for 25 years, and there were numerous bombs in London and Manchester and other parts of Britain, as well as many more in Northern Ireland, the British government responded, and the British public, by kind of saying, well, we're not going to let them get to us, you know, screw them, if you excuse my French. We will just get on with life. And when there was a bomb in London, people would damn well go to work. They would never stay at home. You know, they would make a point of going to work, regardless of the fact that there had been a massive explosion. When there were leaves on the train lines, however, then they'd stay at home. But if there'd been an explosion, there'd be this kind of sense, we must go there, we mustn't let the terrorists get to us. So I think that indicates what I was saying earlier, that it's the psychology of the society, it's the confident nature of the society under threat, which determines how much terrorism will have an impact. So the IRA's campaign, which was a very political, very well-organised, very military-organised campaign, much more so than Al-Qaeda or any of these other new groups, didn't get to Britain in the same way that the threat of Al-Qaeda terrorism — Britain has had no attacks yet in the days after 9/11, the threat of Al-Qaeda terrorism has got to us much more. So I think that indicates a profound shift in British society, not in the shift of a terrorist threat that we are facing.
Look, fellas, thanks for this. I want to go down to the bomb shelter, so we'll terminate this discussion. But Thomas Naylor, economist, criminologist, historian at McGill, I thank you. Brendan O'Neill, London-based journalist, assistant editor of the online magazine Spiked. And Adam Dolnick, a research associate at the International Centre for Political Violence and Terrorism Research at the Institute of Defence and Strategic Studies in Singapore. Boy, what a title. Thank you very much. And that's a wrap from Late Night Live for another week. And I'd like to thank the team: Annabelle Quince, Chris Short, Joe Upham, Chris Bullock, and Paul Goff. Next week, all the regulars and much, much more. Have a bonza weekend.